Donalana Kitchen talks about food. Donalana Kitchen talks recipes. Donalana Kitchen talks about lots of other things on community radio. Welcome to the Donalana Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctical.
And I'm Donna Priskintas.
We are the Donalana Kitchen. We've been doing this on KHOI Community Radio for about a year and a half now. We get together around this kitchen table and talk about lots of different things. Our first order of business today, KHOI just recently finished a great fundraiser. And we thank all of you who supported us with your good wishes and especially all your donations of money to keep us on the air. And today, ta-da, today we are going to announce the premium, the prize winner that was chosen among the millions of new members.
First time new members.
And one of you lucky people out there is going to receive, Donna, tell them what they're going to receive.
Well, I have to say that this is going to be the only fun part of the show today because after that we are going into some bummer news. So listen up for the fun part because this is about chocolate sauce and sour cream gelato prize that I'm going to make, and we're going to deliver it to the next person that Lana is going to mention. Ta-da! Are you ready, Lana? Spin the wheel!
All right.
Okay.
We got it.
Stick your hand in there and pull the name out.
The winner of the gelato prize from the Donalana Kitchen is Raymond England. Ray England. And you will be tracked down and told of this later, of course. But anybody out there that knows Ray, tell them.
He just won
a – how much did he win, Donna? Donna's going to make this, so this is going to be good.
Oh, it's a $1 million prize.
Oh, no, it is.
It's only one person in the world gets to have this. So it's a nice fat jar of hot fudge sauce with a quart of homemade creme fraiche ice cream to put on it. And I have to say about the chocolate sauce, you know, you keep it in the refrigerator and you get it out and warm it up and you put it on the ice cream. However, when it's just sitting there in the refrigerator, it's kind of beckoning. You take a spoon and just eat a mouthful of it right out of the jar. It's like a chocolate truffle.
So Ray, you're going to have a
lucky
good time.
Lucky fellow, Ray.
And
Ray England?
Yeah, Ray England.
Okay.
Ray England as his name, and
Raymond England. Dum dum. Okay.
Yes. The prize will be available in a few. Well, we'll get in touch with you whenever you want that.
I'll bring it to the radio station, and you can pick it up here.
And there's a freezer here. Don't worry.
Yes.
You don't have to hurry.
Do call us. You'll be a happy fellow for a few hours anyway.
And a little bit of business here. Support comes from Wheatsfield Co-op, your full-service natural foods grocery in Ames, community-owned, community-focused since 1974, open daily 7 to 9. Located downtown at 413 Northwestern, just off Main Street in Ames, everyone can shop Wheatsfield Co-op. Thanks to Wheatsfield Co-op for supporting this show. Today on the Donalana Kitchen, we'll consider the land. Take a look outside. What do you see? It's there. The earth feeds us, it houses us, keeps us alive. We're all connected. Joining us on the Donalana Kitchen today is Mark Edwards. He's from Boone, Iowa, has worked for the Iowa Conservation Commission for a long time, and is retired from the Iowa Department of Natural Resources, where his work included initiating the Department of Natural Resources Trails program here in this state. So, welcome, Mark.
Well, good morning.
What have you learned in your time in the great Iowa outdoors?
Well, I've learned that it's much more fun to be here live with you two than even on the radio, and that's pretty good. So I learned that this morning.
Good.
Yeah, Mark's going to help with he's going to help with the bummer news. We do it very lightheartedly, but it's very serious, dark stuff.
Well, it's dark, and it actually gave me a lot of light. Yeah, I mean, when I start learning where I live and everything, but it
and loving where I live,
there's the big part that actually it's made me pretty happy. Even when you see how dark things look out there, it makes it clear which way we need
to go. Gives us a lot to do.
Yeah, well, it'll be easy to make the change. I think we can't continue down the road we're going.
And what road are we going on? Give us a little picture of that.
Well, I think it started for me. Well, it started for me one time. time before that. But in 1980, I read a small little article in the Wapsipinicon Journal, and it talked about junk land, and it started talking about
junk
Iowa.
Junk land.
And that, you know, what we have is junk land, and yet we're going to always put a road through it or something. It was talking about the different controversies within communities of running a road through these little places.
What is junk land? Is that like the garbage dump or something?
Well, you have to start from realizing that Iowa, you know, originally we cultivated 95% of it. So it's the most biologically altered state in North America. So we
Repeat that phrase again. Iowa is the most
biologically altered state in North America.
Oh, and we thought we were living with nature. Hmm.
Yeah. So I think we kind of look at it, you know, we're leading the past, and now we need to talk from that about looking to the future. What can we do to go in a different direction? Because we can't continue developing Iowa. We've developed it all pretty much anyway. One way to understand that, I think, is for the local listeners, say we could talk about Ledges State Park as one specific example, and I can show you pictures where there's not a tree left in that park, hardly. It was completely logged for railroad ties to build the railroad going west.
How long ago?
That was right in the early 1900s. It became a park. It started to become a park in 1927, so by that point it was already logged. It had been heavily grazed. I have a postcard that I found in an antique store talking about people are there and a cow rolls off the hill and falls off the cliff. And sheep grazed, mined. You know, we made good use of that area. And we did that to the whole state. And so out of that, the pieces that were left or that people thought deserved some kind of protection, that's what started the state park system, for example. So by 1934, we led the nation in the establishment of state parks because we had already changed the landscape so much that we knew we had to take care of these last little pieces.
But aren't we kind of low on the percentage of lands that are actually in state parks?
Yeah, we're fighting over the bottom here right now. And
Of all the states, we have some of the smallest amount of state parks.
Yes, you could take all the state parks in Iowa and all the state preserves and put them all together in one place. You have something about 9 miles on a square, which is about the size of the city of Des Moines. So out of 36 million acres,
That's something to think about. Boy, were we ever doing good. Trouble is those things that are set aside are not like in the city of Des Moines or all on 9 miles on a side. They're kind of scattered.
Yeah, very scattered, so much so that they can't maintain their biological diversity.
Postage-stamp sized pieces of prairie remnant.
Forest, we saved them for different reasons. Each park kind of had its own reason of why we saved it. So Ledges, for example, for your local listeners, had a juniper moss reindeer lichen habitat there, which is northern plants which have held on this far south. So it's really rare to see these, and they cover those north-facing slopes in the Ledges.
And that is still there?
That is still there. There's still remnants of that left.
Reindeer like it. Who would have thought?
Yeah. No, and they mean reindeer from way up north.
That's what they eat.
So
be darned.
Quite fascinating. Yeah.
Well, we don't have the reindeer, so.
Well, we used to have elk, actually. More elk than buffalo, but in this part.
Do we have any elk left?
There was a herd that escaped up in northeast Iowa from a elk farm. And there was a lot of controversy at that because then they came in and killed them because they didn't want the spread of disease. So they came in and wiped out those elk that were running around.
What disease?
Chronic wasting disease, which deer get, and they were saying it would come with the elk and stuff also.
How did the deer and the elk used to live here?
Well, I don't know. That's a good question about diseases because we have a lot of things coming in. We could talk about ticks and Lyme's disease. We could talk about the chickens and the turkeys dying by the millions.
Hey, are wild turkeys susceptible to this disease that we're getting in the
– Well, they say that, you know, this came from the wild birds, wild bird flu and everything, but – I haven't heard many reports of
large, dead wild turkeys.
Right. I think there are cases, and I just read there was in the newspaper today of somewhere, Illinois or Indiana, of a wild flock of chickens, I think, got a different kind of bird flu now. So that now there's concern about. But these, you know, things are mutating so fast, and things, you know, change and adapt to a changing landscape. And so where you have a,
so we could turn the elk loose and maybe they'd all deal with it, right?
Maybe, yeah.
Well, yeah, speaking of landscape, I mean, there are animals that are now living their lives in confinement for our convenience, but the Iowa used to be full of animals that were doing things just for Iowa's convenience.
Oh, to read the journals of the first people here walking across the backs of fish across the water.
Yeah.
And, I mean, the plentiful food sources that are here. Just, and you look at how long cultures were here, you know, 10,000, 12,000 years, you know, they didn't seem to be struggling.
They
weren't struggling. They were building mounds, doing lots of cultural events that they must have had a lot of free time.
Well, you know, I saw this,
well put.
This film recently, you know, where they've gone in to track the wildlife regrowth in the Chernobyl area.
Yes.
Because all of a sudden they have a large area where no human beings live, and the wildlife has rebounded tremendously.
Oh, yeah.
If we weren't mucking about with them.
Sure. Well, I think we could look at that in Iowa. You know, there wasn't – I remember, you know, I'd read these accounts where people would see a deer and it would spread through the community so fast that someone had seen a deer. Like that was the rarest thing in the world.
It's
and
true.
Now you're swerving your car around them, you know. So.
Yeah, swatting them out of your garden.
Well, as they try to get from one little remnant to the other, the poor little thing.
Yes.
And yes, they do like hostas and everything else. We can't just call a space around our house ours. It belongs really to the earth. The yard is really just as much for the deer, as far as the deer is concerned, as we are, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Well, do the deer have no predators left? What about coyotes?
No, not coyotes. Disease is predation on them. But people, I'm trying to remember the numbers. I think it's 200,000 a year that we harvest of deer.
Harvest, yes.
Or harvest, yeah. Uh-huh. I love that word. So, trying to think of other things, not really that I can think of. I mean, they've done really well. They like the corn, you know. There's a lot of corn
meat. We do it well.
Speaking of corn, you wrote an article, and the title was Behind the Corn Curtain, A World of Wounds. I thought that was kind of an interesting title, and I have to read this little quote from it. Why is this state advertised as feeding the world when we have to import 86% of what we eat and it travels an average of 1,500 miles to get here? We want the facts to fit how we picture this state, and when they don't, we ignore the facts. I thought that was very well put. Do you want to comment on how you
Well, I read the other day that a quote, and it was saying 90% and 2,000 miles. So I might have underestimated. But I think it brings up the discussion between agriculture in this state and how we live, how people relate and have their needs met and what they eat, where they are. And
yes, because, of course, we are busy, quote, feeding the world here.
Yeah. And in one sense, you know, the things that we're growing, we're exporting those more and more. And that's essentially what's sustaining the economy. And so now with the California drought going on, you know, we're going to have to reevaluate where we get our vegetables from, you know. So
yeah, Lana might have to go back into high gear mode producing food for us.
Well, I've been gardening forever, and I've been expanding my garden and putting up more all the time.
Do you have a high tunnel?
Excuse me?
Do you have a high tunnel?
Not a high tunnel, no.
Well, we may be getting some.
Well, good. I'm going to move there. That's for sure. I want to extend my season.
Yeah, it's interesting to talk about the economy. We think of the economy as cash based, but when it comes to survival, feeding ourselves, having health and good communities, it's funny. We don't seem to put a dollar figure on that, so it gets kind of shuffled away. And it's we have to consider what an economy, what home security really is.
Well, I just read one the other day, and I don't know if you've said this on there or not, but I think Iowa now ranks fourth in the nation in terms of farmers markets. And I thought that's ironic. You know, you're sitting in an agricultural state, and we're quickly moving that. I mean, with organic foods, we're quickly understanding, you know, we can't continue in the system we've had. Yeah. So that was kind of exciting. At least, you know, we're fourth. And
that has changed amazingly. And my heart is gladdened by the fact that there are so many more people that are really willing to take on the hard work and responsibility, and there are more farmers doing small-scale vegetable feed people kind of farmers. Yes. And if you're going to do it in some place, really, truly, the earth underneath our feet right here is not a bad place to start.
No, it's kind of the cream of the crop.
Right. Here. Yeah, I mean, we do have the best soil on the planet, us and the Ukraine, which is being hotly contested these days. So maybe what's going on in Ukraine might be an example of how precious this quality of soil really is.
Right. Well, and, you know, that's really important because you look at, you know, they're saying we've lost, you know, half of our topsoil here. Some are even saying the last 50 years.
Mm-hmm.
And you could also say that, you know, that's what I'm interested in the garden is that I started out with a lot of horse manure and things like that. So I had tremendous grain foliage but not a lot of fruit. And so, you start realizing your soil and the mycelium. I'm very excited by mushrooms and interested in mushrooms. So you realize those mushrooms, that mycelium in the soil is what's growing your food. And that requires, you know, a healthy soil. And
how are you feeding your soil mushrooms?
Oh, I'm bringing wood chips mostly.
They like wood chips.
Mycelium prefer the wood chips,
so I'm putting. What kind of wood chips?
I can get.
They're not particular. Just
well,
different.
There's a whole science expanding now with mycelium and mushrooms in terms of instrumental use in terms of treating our cancers, our woes,
health
things. But it's also they absorb radioactivity back to your Chernobyl thing. They absorb heavy metals. Certain mushrooms have certain things, and there's a whole mushrooming science of all these different species.
So are you actually inoculating your soils with certain kinds
of mushrooms? Yeah, I've been bringing in stuff out of the woods just to see what I could get going.
Oh, wonderful.
And so, really excited by the mushroom side of it because I like eating mushrooms. And it was a great morel year. So.
Yes. Is the morel year over now? Or is it
I don't think so. I think you'd still find some
it's
out
been
there.
Kind of nice and wet and chilly.
I think down in those ravines more.
Yeah. So good luck to all you morel hunters out there. They're wonderful.
Yeah.
Now, I don't want you to give away a site, of course, but do you have a trick for what a companion plant or what you look for?
Well, the dead elms specifically, it doesn't have to be just elms. And, my favorite story is I was driving through Ames one day and there was an empty lot and I looked out there and I picked like 3 or 4 garbage bags of morel mushrooms on an empty lot.
No.
Well, they must have cut the trees a couple years earlier or something because I couldn't explain it any other way. But, morels are magic. You can find those where they shouldn't be.
They know where they want to be, and they will be there. Yes, they will. I've noticed. I don't know whether this has anything to do with it, but there's a nice crop of Jack in the Pulpit. It's kind of the same time the morels are coming this year. Mm-hmm. So it's look at that, and there's one. Oh, there's a lot of nice things in the woods right now.
Yes, there are. I love them when they hang underneath the. I've lost the name, but the big palm leaf that opens up with the white flower. May apples. I just, they kind of got an umbrella over them.
And
they're sitting under there.
It's just downright gnomish, isn't
it? Yes, it is.
There any other mushrooms this time of year that are edible?
Oh, sure. Oh, gosh. Yeah. Oh, tons. Caprinus family is auto-digest. They turn black and icky. You'll see those on your straw. Your
auto-digest.
Yeah.
Good word.
And you got to eat those right away. You can't put those up. And
Because they auto-digest.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah. But some of them are so sought after that they would fly them to New York for steak sauce. I mean, that's.
Wow.
So you're talking a special mushroom.
Some umami flavor in those, probably.
Ooh. Yeah.
Ooh, lovely.
So there's a lot of. Good eating out there in the mushroom family. There's lots of edible mushrooms.
And the thing is, we have to preserve the places for these mushrooms to be because they really take care of themselves quite well if they have a good woods to be in or a good, Yeah, most of them are related to trees, related to wood chips. They don't grow in fields with the corn.
Right. And another way to look at mushrooms, you know, is they're just like the organisms that live in your stomach that allow you to digest your food, because mm-hmm. without them, you're mm-hmm. not going to get very far. So they serve that function.
Oh, I want to get back to something you mentioned earlier. Ticks. Is this going to be a bad tick year, as they say?
Well, you know, one of the best indicators of tick
are dogs.
Numbers. That's for finding them.
Yes, yes. I've only had one so far this year.
Oh, really? I had one, at least over a month ago, at mm-hmm. least. And, mm-hmm. and I guess the more out in the timber, the more I find them. But a good indicator is the nut crop from the previous year, because then it's all the other species that live off the nut crop. So the turkeys, the mice, all these things that are related to those kinds of food sources are really
the and ticks. And then the ticks live
at different stages of the tick, they live on different hosts, and the host size gets bigger as their stages continue.
So if there was a good nut crop last fall, that means the people that eat the nut crops are thriving.
Yes.
And then the hosts for the ticks are thriving.
Yes.
Oh, how lovely.
Yeah.
So how was the nut crop last fall?
Well, I'm trying to think. On some nut trees, I'm trying to think walnuts. I track the walnuts more because they're a good protein source, and I love eating walnuts. But the oak trees, I don't think last year was a good year. I think – and they kind of go in cycles sometimes, three-year cycles mm-hmm. or something like that.
Can you predict the mosquito cycles too?
Boy. we're going to see this year.
That has to do with moisture levels, right?
Yeah, standing water more and that kind of stuff.
So. Well, we've had worse years for standing water.
Yeah, and, you know, it's a trade-off every year.
Yeah.
It's Iowa, I guess.
You had, speaking of, we were about to talk about mushrooms a little bit. I saw you last week, and you handed me a plant. And I always try to look into new herbs and new things to eat. And I tasted this, and it tasted like anise. You gave me, talk about sweet Sicily.
Oh, sweet Sicily. I really like sharing time in the woods with kids. Kids always show me what's going on out there because they'll focus on stuff that I don't give the attention to. And so I try to learn plants so that I can share that plant use with them so that they'll remember the name or something and make some connection. And so sweet Sicily is a great one because, like I say, it's licorice. And most kids know licorice. So and it's they used to use the root. They would dig it up. And it's fairly common out there in the timber. And it's a nice, delicate-looking little white umbral flower. And a nice, soft-looking leaf.
Kind of how tall does it grow?
About 2 feet, 2.5 uh-huh. feet at the tallest. About
shade,
in there.
Sun?
Shade. You find it more in the shade. Uh-huh. Cattle, pretty heavy grazing on it. They like it. So
you get licorice milk then.
Yeah, and I always think of licorice, you know, for your stomach upsetness. And there's a lot of herbal use of licorice.
Sicily has the qualities of
yes,
licorice
it's actually,
for the digestion.
Yeah, very, very strong.
In the licorice family.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very strong. And people used to use it to make candy. I mean, it was used a lot back in the past here in Iowa for cookies and all kinds of things.
Yes, I have a little reference here that says the roots have been used as a cough remedy. And also that anise flavor, good for flavoring cabbage, carrots, parsnips, and fruit dishes. So there you go. Yeah. And Donna, take note of that, because Donna has a very shady yard, and this is the kind of thing that you can kind of grow in the shade.
Do you think you could dig some up in the wild and put them?
Sure, they kind of colonize. So you'll find them in kind of groups, and then, you know, you can take some out of each group, and so you won't really affect that. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't take much. It's pretty strong stuff. So if you dig up the root, you know, and you can dry it. I've dried it, put it in stuff. You can slice it up. And
so the root is the only part that you use?
Yeah, pretty much. I try to play around different plants. That's how I remember the names.
Right.
So, but I just chew on the root whenever I'm out in the woods.
So the leaf doesn't have a...
The leaf, okay, now there's two plants that look very, very similar, flower-wise, leaf-wise, height-wise, everything, except that the sweet Sicily has like a dark stem, very purplish dark skin. And the other is a false sweet Sicily.
Of course.
And it has a green stem. Okay. And so it doesn't have any anise or licorice thing quality. So you can easily tell.
Just by tasting.
Just by and you can actually – the piece I gave you, I think I just broke off the top. I didn't even disturb the root. Mm-hmm. I just broke off the
stem. Top has flavor too.
Yeah, not as much. The root really is powerful.
So if you, like for ginger. Example, chopped some leaves into the salad, would it get a little –
Yeah,
I think
yeah, I'd probably look into that. But yeah, I've chewed on the leaf. I don't remember anything.
Wasn't memorable. Okay.
Yeah. So
go for it.
I taste a lot of things and go. Well, it didn't affect me, so I guess it was okay.
Forest grazer.
You are listening to KHOI 89.1. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. We'll have a little music break here. Welcome back. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. Donna and I are here with Mark Edwards. We're talking about the earth, Iowa underneath us, and all the wonderful things it grows, how we relate to the world around us, the ecology that we are part of. So, Mark, you've been involved a lot in teaching people about the environment and about Iowa. You started the...
Right. Mark has a 30-year career with the DNR, so he's a bit of an expert, or as good as we get, anyway.
As good as we get. You talk about doing the trails program and some of the programs you got going, because without that, we couldn't access some of these places.
Right. Well, it started in Ledges. I got my first job because it was right up the road, and there was – two facets of that. One, they had received a lot of money in mitigation from building the Sailorville Dam, and they were going to flood the ledges, and that goes way back. And so one of the compensations was that is to give money to the park to kind of address the bottom part flooding almost every year. And so that – some part of that money went into what they called the Trails Program. And the Trails Program was to – they were going to build this gigantic overlooked deck on the ledges there overlooking the river valley, and I knew it to be a Native American site that I had not publicized much about because I was very protective of that. And when I saw they were going to build a deck on top of it, I thought, well, I better get involved. And so I came and talked to the at that time it was the Conservation Commission about why they shouldn't do this, and ended up finding they had a job opening. And so, like I say, I lived just south of there, a mile and a half. So I said, well, I'll take the job of building the deck, and we never built the deck. So I felt my career was a success on that level.
That is an interesting way of getting a job.
Good idea.
And from that, I learned, and we had money the first couple of years, and the ledges was so devastated by overuse. We had, at that point in time, we were having about 500,000 people a year coming to that park. So it was going downhill rapidly. I mean, I started out working in foot trails, trying to stabilize those, and they were 6 and 8 feet deep.
Oh, my.
So, I mean, at the time, people just thought they were walking up these ravines, but they were actually had been foot trails and eroded down that far.
Wow.
And so we're back to the reindeer lichen juniper moss colonies that are there, which are so rare. That's why the park was designated, and those colonies were just getting destroyed. So we went back trying to really – and as I said, I build trails to take care of the place, and people are allowed to walk on them. So I'm trying to reduce their impacts is what the trail is. So the trail is more a stabilizing feature.
It's like a way to herd the people.
It's a way to herd. And you know, a lot of people like to go fast. So when you make the trail so they can go fast, they go fast and everything. But at that time, you know, it was really sad to go into that park with 500,000 people. And there was, you know, packed. It was crowded. And so there was lots of ramifications.
That's because we need more park space.
Well, yeah, we definitely need more park space. So that expanded rapidly, and I learned that as that money ran out, then I had to write grants. So I started writing grants, and I was extremely successful at writing grants because I would talk about the devastation that I was seeing and that most people couldn't even see. And that seemed to be a very good way to get money. And so I was extremely successful. That's why I branched out and helped start the Water Trails Program. We started the interpretive program,
what
the DNR.
Talk about what's a Water Trails Program?
A Water Trails Program is focusing more on the kayaking, canoeing, fishing, boating, that kind of thing, using the last remnants that are left in Iowa, essentially, which is always the sad part of this. You know, the flip side is always, you know, you want people to, the paradox, get out and enjoy it so they'll fall in love with it. And in the same time, we all have impacts. And so in Iowa, which is, you know, the most biologically altered state in North America, we've only got about 1 or 2% left out there with any integrity, and a lot of it is the river courses. And the river courses are critical because they're also the corridors.
Is that because people don't own the rivers?
Pretty much. It's kind of like looked at as public. That's you've hit it right on the head. It's public space, and there's very little. Iowa has some of the least amount of public land of all the states.
So
it's become very critical out there.
What do you think about the this much praised cleanup of the Iowa River?
You mean it's like Project Aware or something like that?
Yeah,
or,
I mean
just –
why just that river? Can't we do – what about the Skunk
River?
Well,
we started a program called Project Aware, and each year it moves to a different river, and it happens during the summer months, and hundreds of volunteers show up, and we go up and down those rivers, and, you know, we give education programs, and we talk about cleaning up. So, you know, they bring in tons and tons of material of just trash and garbage that are out there. And so it's a good way to get people out there that haven't been out there, and it's also a good illustration of what a mess, how they've been our dumps forever, you know. And so it's, you know, it's a good way to show people about water quality, talk about lots of different things. But like I say, it's because those are the things that are left out there. You know, we have so little left that I'm also very scared of, you know, exploitation of these areas as we try and get more and more people out there. So it's that paradox of how do you get people to love a place and not –
that you talk about exploiting it. If these are public places, you mean somebody could set up a beer and lemonade stand and get, have at it and spread cups all over?
You go. It's also the quality of experience that we're talking about. You're going down the water to see waterfowl or whatever species are out there and the quiet, and you're floating along and no engines are running and no games and no video. And you know, and yet you have – for example, over here you have hundreds of people at one time come by you with kegs and, you know, and everything
flotilla,
else. And the beer cans are floating by. And, you know, I'm glad they're out there, but I don't think they're out there for the same reasons that the other people are out there. So, you know, that's indicative of a lot of our public areas.
We don't have enough land to buffer our impact. It's just amazing. You wrote a little bit about in your article on the corn curtain and what's behind us growing all this corn, the fewer and fewer species, bird species are declining, mainly because they just don't have habitat. They can't jump from one little postage stamp to the next. You mentioned something called the lesser scalp duck. I've never heard of a lesser scalp duck.
Scob duck is the most common diving duck in North America.
Huh?
Okay, and so it's depends on the organisms that live in the water. And so it cannot migrate across the state of Iowa without losing so much body weight that it can't reproduce, or they actually starve to death because there's so little left of those critters that they eat in the water.
What kind of critters?
Neotodes are small organisms
so
that
not,
they filter
not
out.
Fish, not tadpoles.
They're not more. They're more smaller down on the food chain. So you know that's the part we don't see. You know, we can only kind of relate to what we can see on some level. But you know, I'm trying to give some definition of here's a duck that can't, you know, that can't even get across the state. And that's pretty indicative. I use that as the example of, you know, when you start looking at the importance of connecting up what is left, we have to connect Minnesota and Missouri. That's our role, our east and west with Illinois. Places that have some habitat left, which in Iowa we really don't really have that left. Mm-hmm. So our job is to somehow in the future be that avenue, be that corridor connecting those things up. And
In the DNR, and also speaking for yourself, how concerned are you about things that you don't, in terms of pollution levels, things that you can't see? Now, obviously, you can see, you know, tin cans and pull them out of the river. Mm. And, of course, habitat loss does contribute to why some of these animals are not doing very well. But there's some degree that our heavy load of, like, glyphosate and stuff like that is affecting –
absolutely.
Reproduction, and we can't, you know, the river may look fine, but.
Right, right.
Should we be swimming in it? I'm not sure.
Yeah, well, if you want to be in the water and you want to be out of the chlorine, you're going to be in something else.
Yeah, exactly.
So, but I think that's a good way of looking at it because we're making trade-offs all the time. And, you know, if we're an agricultural state and we're putting the pesticides, herbicides, all these chemicals, all this continually going off in this direction, you know, we can't expect to have that in our systems. In the food that
right.
we
it does
eat.
Not stay it, on the field.
No. And it's in the air. I think, gosh, back in the 80s or something, I think they did rainwater and they had like 12 different chemicals in the rainwater coming down. So, I mean, it's there. It's part of what we live with.
Well, how is the DNR figuring this into the equation? Are they doing any kind of educational or mitigation or –
well, I wish I could speak for the DNR. I can't, but I'll tell you, in my lifetime, it's become even a more of a political organization. It's not.
Oh, dear.
It has a hard time following its mission, I should say. And, you know, we're spending less and less on it all the time, which is just appalling. I mean, the numbers of people working out there is going down. The budgets are going down. They're getting focused onto different things. I mean, hunting, fishing, you know, mm-hmm. those kind of things. Mm-hmm.
Well, we did have a wonderful lady on the show that talked about taking the lead out of not using lead in your hunting.
Kay Newman.
Yeah.
I've learned a lot from her. She's very good at giving us the information again about what's happening on the landscape.
And that seems a very doable thing if you just have everybody switch their ammunition.
Yeah, I found an eagle actually dying from lead poisoning. It's a very gruesome thing to watch.
You didn't take it to soar? Or it was too far gone?
No, actually, this is up in Northeast Iowa, and it went up into, I think it was La Crosse or something. The Fish and Wildlife people, federal, came and took it.
Mm-hmm. So. Sometimes the damage we see seems awfully large. Are there things we can do? Can you replant a wild area? Can you remake a wild park, a park that kind of goes to the wild?
Well, that's a good question because philosophically now there's a discussion about, you know, you can't go back because even the organisms in the soil are changed. So you have to start looking forward, and that's why, you know, I think we need a vision, something to inspire us, and that's why I talk about this connecting Missouri and Minnesota. We need to start looking on a landscape level, and we also need to get down into the conservation ecology level of looking at the health of our soil. So, I mean, it's all levels, vertical and horizontal. And like, say we've gone down this road, we've developed, you know, 98% of Iowa. What are you going to do? Develop the last 2%, and then what are you going to do? I mean, we're at the point where we have to go in a different direction now. We have to. And so that brings up the question of water quality, public lands, the kind of agriculture we're doing, confinements. We could go on and on. I mean, it's exciting time in a way. I mean, in some ways it seems real dark, but in another way it's exciting time because we're going to have to redefine the future here now. And we hopefully we can make choices now that we couldn't have made in the past because we can see we're at a dead
end.
Yeah,
it's a little – it gets more and more obvious, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. I think it's –
at least to us, right?
Well, and I think people – it's permeating lots of people. When it comes down to lawsuits over water quality and then you've got political figures taking sides. Mm-hmm. You know things are getting bad when things are splitting out into two approaches to the world.
That's true. People get our hackles up over things, but at least we are aware of issues. There's a lot of things we have to talk about, and developing an ethic for how we deal with the land that we live on is maybe the next step in our human evolution.
I hope so.
I hope so, too.
Get some nature hunger going on.
Yeah, there we go.
You're listening to KHOI. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. If you can't get enough of the Donna Lana Kitchen, you can go to the KHOI website. That's khoifm.org. Look for the Donna Lana Kitchen page and find everything you need to know about the past show.
We've archived it all there.
And there's a recipe or two. And if you want to contact us, give us ideas for shows, give us some advice, give us some recipes, let us know what you think of this show. That's our email address is khoiradio@gmail.com and kind of indicate Donna Lana Kitchen somewhere in there. And we'd love to hear from you. We'll have a little music here, a little Celtic music, and I love the name of this. This is called Dusty Windowsills.
Thank you.
Welcome back. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. We're here in the studio with Mark Edwards. We're talking about Iowa land. We affect the places that we live, and the places we live affect us a lot, too. There's a lot of...
More than we know.
Yeah, there's some legislation currently. There are some things that we can do collectively.
In the state legislature.
So tell us about that, Mark.
Well, it's... started a little bit back before the current proposals, and that was the REAP program. More people might be associated with that, the Resource Enhancement and Protection Program. And we started that back in the late 90s there. And it was – if it had been funded, the idea was if it had been fully funded on the front end, it would have lived off the interest pretty much. Well, we didn't do that then. And so now we're trying again to bring some money back into the natural resources, and there's a – bill called the National Resources and Outdoor Recreation Trust Fund, and it was began in 2010, and 63% of the voters voted that they wanted to see this funded and applied and put into practice. And now they're even saying that that number has probably gone up as we better understand the deteriorating water quality and things. And it was based on an increase of 0.3 cents of sales tax, and that was going to bring in about $180 million annually. And of which, to give you an example, $40 million of that would be directly going to land acquisition and enhancement.
That means getting more parks?
It could very well be, yeah. We just added a piece up to the Yellow River State Forest up in northeast Iowa, critical national bird area. That was money that came from Audubon and out of REAP and various sources. But, yeah, a critical piece of land that we've been trying to get for 20 years. And so now if there was some kind of funding mechanism in place, we could pick those areas up even quicker.
Good.
So this piece of legislation for a teeny-weeny increase in sales tax is on the agenda today?
Yes, it is. And actually, you should be calling your politician representatives and demanding that they do this because we have to do it at some point. Otherwise, it's just going to get down to real gruesome fights over cleaning your water so you can drink it and things like that. So it has a lot of ramifications.
We're pretty close to that anyway.
Yes, we are.
Well, good. It's good to know there's something we can do. So all those politicians that you elected, make them work for that, work for themselves.
Call here. Herman yeah. Kumbach.
Yes, very good.
Yeah.
Let them know that you have an opinion.
Iowa land is part of all of us, so let's take care of our home ground here, folks. I want to talk about an experiment that I'm doing on my farm. I tend to read a lot of, permaculture publications and new ways to farm, new ways to think about things. And I ran across the plant I just couldn't say no to. I gave a chance to this plant. I ordered it from a nursery.
Of course, it's something edible, so we're going to be cooking with it.
It is something edible.
I can hardly wait.
It's berries on a bush, and I've heard that these berries are extremely good for you.
The pictures are lovely, let me tell you.
That always helps. The plant is called sea berry or sea buckthorn.
It has nothing to do with the ocean.
No. Yeah. And nothing to do with – actually, I don't know if it has to do with regular buckthorn either. But anyway, it is a non-native. It is thought to originate in Eastern Europe and Siberia. So it is a hardy, hardy sort of thing.
But it does have a lot of vitamin C in it,
yes.
too.
Yes. It's a bushy, thorny little plant, great on hedgerows, little gray leaves, and beautiful little orange berries. The sea berry's Latin name, which is Hypophae – Reminoides means shining horse, and legend has it that Genghis Khan fed his armies sea berries before he entered into battle because these are native to Siberia and northern China. Hardy, hardy. They are hardy like down to 50 below zero and actually don't mind bad soil. They need full sun. So I ordered some of these wonderful little thorny bushes.
So we'll be making... jelly, maybe?
You can make jelly. You can make juice. They have little orange berries.
Are they very tart, do we think?
We don't know yet. We will grow them and find out. And guess what, folks?
Unknown.
Guess what? Supposedly, this is a nitrogen-fixing plant. More about the...
How virtuous.
More nitrogen-fixing, and the berries are supposed to be very, very high in vitamin C. So for the Genghis Khan on the steppes, it was probably a pretty good thing to be feeding your armies and your horse. So that we'll be I'll keep you up on the process of these berries growing. So I always like to try new things, don't you, Mark?
You bet. Even things that aren't good for me sometimes.
Now, this is supposed to be really good for you. Really good for you, yes. And I got the information from the Seabury book from a book on permaculture called The Resilient Farm and Homestead. It's a man that has set up a permaculture farm in Vermont, of all places. His name is Ben Falk, F-A-L-K. And his farm, he's even growing upland rice there. It's a beautiful book to look at, but he's trying all kinds of things.
Some clever ideas, yeah.
Clever ideas and really interested in providing a lot of on-the-farm nutrient-dense foods. So but he's got all kinds of other things, too. But I thought these sea berries sound like a good idea. And if nothing else, they're clear out there along the fence row, and we're just going to see what they do and see if they can make it through an Iowa winter.
I bet they'll attract deer.
They probably will, but
bright red color.
But the thorns already are pretty little snarly. They're
so
kind of a
prickly, protecting.
They're kind of a prickly little hedge here. We'll see. We'll see who gets to the fruit first. It's always good. Well, any more thoughts on taking care of loving the land here?
Well, we got a lot to figure out here, that's for sure. And I hope this conversation continues more and more because we're barely scratching the surface here.
That's true. We'll have you back because we have lots to talk about. That's good. I want to take this time to, again, congratulate our KHOI fundraiser,
Ray England,
who was our new member winner. And
he's going to get the chocolate sauce, hot fudge sauce, and homemade ice cream.
Oh, uh-huh. How nice. How nice. So, Donna will make up a batch just for you. We'll go out with another tune here from the musician, a hammer dulcimer player named Karen Ashbrook, and some other people playing too. This last tune, these are great names, this last tune is called The Poor Old Woman. I don't know. You just have to relate to these tunes one way to the other. So, you've been listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen with special guest Mark Edwards. Music by Karen Ashbrook and friends. Support this station. We'd love to hear from you. KHOIRadio@gmail.com. We'll get you our email and you can tell us what you think of this show, what you think of other shows. Send us a recipe. Give us some advice.
Send us some recipes for whatever you got growing in your garden.
Yeah, we'd love to find out what's going on and learn something new. Be part of this community voice. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. I'm Lana Noctical.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
With excellent engineering, as always, by Rick. Eat good food and enjoy life.
All right.